Hello again, everyone. Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. Good to see you. Welcome to part 6 of the Diamond Sutra Perfection of Wisdom study. We're pretty close to done with it. But I don't want to skip anything. I'm already skipping around. And as I've encouraged you before, great book to read. A lot of scholarship. I really appreciate that. Let's get right into it, okay? Don't have as much light in this room today. In fact, I'm going to turn one on if that's all the same to you. Can I reach it? Maybe that'll be enough. I don't want to whitewash the whole picture for you. On that occasion, now we are in chapter 26. On that occasion, the Buddha then spoke this gatha. Who looks for me in form, who seeks me in a voice, indulges in wasted effort. Such people see me not. By now, we're firmly into the Mahayana section of this teaching. We know that the Buddha is the mind. And in fact, I'm going to go ahead and say it, although this will get us into Lotus Sutra territory. The Lotus has been quoted several times in here by other scholars as well as in the text, just other scholars. Not only is the Buddha the mind, but it is the life, it's usually called life force, but let's get more modern, more real about this. It's life energy. It is the interminable quiescent energy of all potential. From all potential precipitates phenomena. Not only are you a phenomena, the mind is a phenomena. You can't find qualities or define it by its attributes. The mind is the mind. We know it because we're sentient beings. But that mind fundamentally comes from the quiescent energy, or perhaps easier to understand, the energy that starts to take potential and make it manifest. And it's not only you and other people and animals and so forth, everything we experience as real, but this entire universe is made exactly the same way. An amalgam of energies, poof, manifesting into something, a phenomena. And when the phenomena, like all things, is impermanent, it decays and falls into noumena. So you got to change your vocabulary a little bit, because that noumena basically says nothing. But if you take the word nothing apart, it's no thing. It's not like the previous words we've used, empty or void. Those are too easily categorized as nothing. But no thing actually means that there is potential for things, energy. But when there is no thing, that means within that vast energy, there is no phenomena. There is only potential for phenomena. That's Buddha. And that, because it's integral to our own self-awareness, us being here, is the result of Buddha, not a person, but that energy. And we're an amalgam from it, like all things are. That's the oneness we're talking about in Mahayana. The full brunt of Shakyamuni's teachings. Okay? So, go on with another quote here. This chapter explains the apparition body. The apparition, what does apparition mean? It appears to be, but it is not. It does, these are apparitions, these are visions, these are mind-made entities. The Buddha is one. And this body is not true in order to show that the Dharma body is free of attributes. Subhuti, what do you think? Can the Tathagata be seen by means of possession of attributes? Subhuti replies, no, indeed, Bhagavan. As I understand the meaning of what the Buddha says, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. So if it has no attributes, what then is it? It is no thing. Not nothing, but no thing. You can say it's the same thing, but I think it's helpful to break apart the syllables because it makes a clearer perception of what is being taught here. Okay? If the Buddha has no self, being, life, or soul, what exactly is the Buddha? I got ahead of myself and defined it already, but let's go with what the Diamond Sutra and its analysis says. The Buddha is, by definition, the embodiment of enlightenment, the Buddha nature personified. But what is the nature of such a nature? On several occasions, Chao Cho's disciples asked him if a dog had the Buddha nature. On one occasion, he answered, no. On another, he answered, yes. The difference depended on the disciples and whether Chao Cho perceived the disciple as attached to the phenomenal or to the nominal world. There's that word we're starting here, nominal. Nothingness, to existence or to non-existence. Over time, however, Chao Cho's no, wu in Chinese, mu in Japanese, became one of the most popular koans of Zen, and his yes was forgotten. It would appear that Subhuti too preferred no to yes. The Maha Prajnaparamita Sastra says, if the 32 attributes of the Mahayana are the result of karma, and the attributes of all Buddhas of the 10 directions and the dharmas of the past, present, and future are not attributes, why now speak of 32 attributes? If even one attribute is false, how much more so 32? Answer. There are two kinds of Buddha dharmas. One is provisional, worldly truth. And the other is ultimate, final truth. So, again, this is a clue to studying all of the Buddhist teachings and scholarship. There are always two voices present. I'm having problems with words today. There are always two languages present. The language of the world that wants to communicate to the human condition is one thing, but it's used to infer or to lead to the meaning, not the words, the meaning being this other language which speaks to the fundamental truth that we're trying to get to understand. So you could see if the fundamental truth is something that we don't just immediately perceive and see around us, whatever language, quote unquote, it might use to identify itself would completely lose us because it's not of our world, our samsaric condition. All right? So this is why there's a worldly language that terms things in words so that we can put together an efficient understanding and pry apart the meaning. Once we get to the meaning, the language, the worldly language, has no relevance. Because when you know something, like fundamental energy and Buddha, there's no need for language. You just know. So that's what we're trying to get. In terms of provisional truth, we speak of the 32 attributes. In terms of the ultimate truth, we speak of no attributes. It's kind of an easy reversal of language, but that's still not it. You know, I hope we're there by now. Thus, there are two kinds of path. The first leads beings to cultivate the path of merit. The second is the path of wisdom. Because of the path of merit, we speak of the 32 attributes. Because of the path of wisdom, we speak of no attributes. Now you can maybe understand why this is called the perfection of wisdom. Because the logic that we use every day is a conditioned human existence language. But if we can transcend the limitations of that language to get to fundamental truth, well then, we have developed our wisdom beyond the label wisdom, I would say. Okay, in terms of the apparition body, we speak of 32 attributes. In terms of a real body, we speak of no attributes, because there's no body. So kind of take it apart by going backwards. Tao Chuan says, mold clay, carve wood, and paint some silk, add blue and green, and gild it all with gold. But if you think the Buddha looks like this, the goddess of compassion will die from laughter. This all, now that I've read that, I should also interject that in the Buddha's many sutras and teachings, his sermons, he urged his followers, don't follow me. Literally, don't, not just images of me or statues of me or all those kind of things. Fine, you can do those to play, but don't worship those things. Don't focus your energy on those things, me included. Why? Because he just explained it. I ain't here. You're wasting your time. And also, you're grounding yourself and cultivating more attachment to a thing. A thing that is impermanent, that does not, in the final analysis, exist. Don't do that. Study the teachings, figure out their meaning, and meditate, concentrate on your own perceptions and what you need to do. That's the practice. There have been mandalas in an attempt to transcend that, but they're all pictorial, so they got pictures of things. The best mandala that I've ever seen was Nichiren's mandala. Why? Because it wasn't a picture. It was very specific and not even one singular language, because it was a mixture of Siddham and Pali and Sanskrit and Chinese characters and Japanese names and characters. All those came, as I've told you before, all those names are really about concepts. They're not real people. They're like we call Shakyamuni Buddha Buddha, but that's really an error. That's why I try to use Shakyamuni Buddha every time I identify him, because I'm still sensitive to the human language that wants to give him the entity of Buddha. He's not Buddha. He has Buddha, and he's realized it completely, and he's made the choice to stay in this condition of humanity in order to help others gain that understanding and reach their own Buddhahood. So the characters on a Gohonzon are representative of certain concepts that were labeled with names, like Bodhisattva this and Buddha that and Bodhisattvas of the earth and other concepts, the medicine king and those kind of things. They're really not persons, but they're representations of certain facets of our human condition that leads us toward prajna, perfection, Okay, so the Gohanzen is actually a scribe of all the concepts contained ultimately in the ultimate Mahayana teaching, the Lotus, that has all of these other things in it, so that that mandala, instead of being something to penetrate something other, because it has attachments to it, you could say names are attachments too, but the names are of concepts. And what we try to do with the Gohanzen is use it as a reflector of our own Buddha nature. In other words, if you're looking for your Buddha nature, it looks like this. This ain't it, but it looks like this. And it'll help you, give you an item to focus on to awaken that reality in you, to awaken that prajna, wisdom in you. It's tricky because, you know, Buddhism is a practice of how do we liberate ourselves from the foibles of humanity, human life, the way we work, the way a human being thinks and the mind operates. To get underneath it, we have to use conditioned devices and try to clean them up as much as possible so that they don't distract, but at the same time provide us in our human condition something to guide our idea of what we're doing. It's the best I can describe a Gohanzen. It's not a holy thing. It's an aid. It's an aid for you to look back into yourself for, hey, remember this? Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Remember, this is the title of the teachings. This has all the five periods of the teachings. It has those meanings. Okay. I don't want to get too far off track here. Let's continue. The Buddha said, well done, Subhuti, well done. So it is. It is as you claim. The Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. And why not, Subhuti? If the Tathagata could be seen by means and of the possession of attributes, a universal king would be a Tathagata. Hence, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. One Zen master became so fed up with his disciples' attachment to the concepts of Buddhas and Buddhahood, he announced that henceforth, if he spoke the word Buddha, he would go down to the stream and wash out his mouth. One of his disciples rose to the occasion and responded, and if you do, I will go down to the stream and wash out my ears. Thus, as the sutra nears its conclusion, the Buddha asked Subhuti to consider the nature of Buddhahood, lest bodhisattvas become attached to a goal. You understand that? Why so much negativity about reaching a goal? I mean, I've used the word goal when I'm teaching Buddhism because I'm using it in the first language. The human condition needs to be driven towards something. But now we're near the conclusion, so he's going to start making his point really directly. And what he's saying is, just like the self-no-self thing, any goal that you think is worthy of your time and effort becomes a straw man. You know that concept? It becomes another real thing. And what you end up doing is chasing this goal that you'll never reach because you don't need a goal. You already have, you are made up of, you are the result and continuum of Buddha. Your goal isn't to get somewhere. Your goal is to get the chaff and the, remember the corn field? Just get out of there. Just be Buddha. But so all of these other perceptions that we have, because we're in samsara, because we're in this conditioned mind, it's in the way of our knowing, not learning, but knowing we are Buddha. Everything is Buddha. And once we really, really get rid of all those other obstacles and just sit in our Buddhahood, everything becomes clear because you're no longer attached to anything. So this is the method. One by one, find and realize your attachments and appease them is a good word. Because you can't just go, okay, I don't like ice cream anymore. And if you can do that, good on you. But generally, we have to make ice cream, our thoughts of ice cream, feel okay and just not pay attention to them. That's different. That's different than like an alcoholic who's in Alcoholic Anonymous for 50 years, and every day he's there, he stands up and says, I'm an alcoholic. Dude, there's a lot of great things about those meetings, and I'm not writing it off outright, but I'm pointing out to you that he's still extremely attached, and every meeting he goes to, in fact, he renews his attachment. Instead of learning that that thought that says, man, I could use a drink right now, and saying, well, maybe you could, maybe you can't, maybe you shouldn't need to. I mean, I'm just going to, every time you come up in my mind, I'm just going to have a glass of orange juice and feel good. And over time, that thought will cease to have, it won't come up as easily. It'll start out saying, man, I'll just have some orange juice. It loses its power. Okay? What do I mean by loses its power? The attachment is waning till the day comes when you just don't have that thought anymore. You know, when I was younger, I smoked cigarettes. And one day I felt my throat was starting to burn. But you know, when you like something, you just keep doing it. So I kept smoking, thought, it'll pass. And then I got a big old sinus infection. And then I couldn't smoke. It didn't even taste good. And in my mind, I thought, well, if I can attach this yucky experience, if it's going to burn my throat or give me infections to smoke cigarettes, I really don't need to do that. And that worked for me. You know, maybe a year, maybe 2 years later, what did I see in that smoking in the first place anyway? I thought there was a pleasantness to it. So I tried different flavored cigarettes. And that was fun for a little while, maybe a month. And I started feeling that burn coming again. I thought, I really don't need this. And that was my whole smoking experience. I didn't go through this huge trauma of, I gotta have my nicotine. But, you know, I never was a person who smoked a pack a day either. I could have a pack of cigarettes and it would go stale before I finished it. So maybe that's my good fortune. So it made it very easy for me to walk away from. And I haven't smoked since. Although on occasion, I really liked those clove cigarettes for a while. And I kind of, you know, I'm a painter. So when I'm focused on painting and so forth, it'd be kind of nice because I forget to eat or whatever. But I never even bought the pack. Because I remember, I really don't need that. So the thought may arise again a decade later. But it won't have the power because I'm no longer attached to it. It's still roving around in my brain, my mind, but it doesn't have power. So this is the whole method of discovering our Buddha nature. If we can do that with all of our attachments, our myriad thousands of attachments, and the different forms that our attachments take, that's also important. Because my ability to just quit smoking like that is the same thing that I learned from quitting alcohol and quitting other things. I can't stand up today and say, I'm addicted to smoking and I'm an alcoholic. It sounds stupid for me to say that. Why? Because those thoughts don't arise anymore in me. They have no power. I'm no longer attached to them. Hooray for me. I got rid of some attachments. Got lots, lots more. Been doing this 30 years. I got a lot of attachments. Believe me, I've seen my life change through Buddhism year after year after year. But I'm always reminded every decade that I may have gotten rid of an attachment, but that attachment was part of 10,000 more that are related to another attachment. And so I've been climbing that pyramid of attachments from where there are hundreds of thousands to 100,000 to tens of thousands. I'm not going to go any further than that because I'd be lying to myself. I know I got a bunch to work through yet. But that's cool because I have a really good guide to how to live my life through Buddhism. That's really what we're talking about here. So, back to the book. The Venerable Subhuti said to Buddha, as I understand the meaning of what the Buddha says, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. On that occasion, the Buddha then spoke this gatha. Who looks at me in form, who seeks me in a voice, indulges in wasted effort. Such people can see me not. As Sangha says, who only sees and hears him doesn't know the Buddha. The Tathagata Dharma body isn't the realm of cognition. So to know Buddhism intellectually, now there's a lot of you who need to hear this. You can intellectualize anything. And it, just because you know every single scripture or sermon or writing, and you can recite them back and forth, doesn't mean that you're working through the Buddhist method to be enlightened or awakened. What it means is you're a good scholar. But until you dive your heart into this, until, you know, there's a word that I really can't stand that English and Western translators use in translating from Sanskrit, Pali, Chinese. They like to use the word faith. And I'm not telling you can't use it, but here's why I have a problem with it. Faith, especially in the West, is generally a term that has attached to its meaning the possibility or the probability that you should believe something without question. And that is not the Buddha's teaching. That is not Shakyamuni's teaching. That is not the scholarship of the teaching. Over and over and over again, what is really being talked about, and especially in China is a great example, when they have a character for the mind, Shen, the intelligence, the knowing is Shen. Shen is a combination character that includes both the heart and the mind, or the heart and the brain, if you will. But it's a spiritual word because it's not contained in an organ. The brain and the heart they're talking about is a sensation. Okay, so when you, with your mind, really, the more you study what you develop more confidence, conviction, and determination to go on further. So your commitment becomes very, very strong. So when we talk about a strong mind, we're not talking about faith. We're talking about some determination that you're intellectually making with your mind to dig deeper, to find more meaning in what you read, to succeed at cultivating from the intellectual the purpose and the result of the practice, which is to be at one with Buddha, to remove our consciousness from samsara. Okay, now Sheng Yi says, form itself contains no suffering. It is attachment that contains suffering. So there it is. Intellectually, we see a door as a door because we read its form. We read the way that it works, the way that it looks, the way that it's sized, the way that it exists. But that's not its fundamental nature. That's its form. That's intellectual. What it actually is something of an attachment. That's why it exists in our minds. Now, I'm not saying you can walk through doors. I'm just trying to make an example Sometimes I hear myself and my other self that's trying to attack me and ask me questions, go, yeah, what about this? It makes me laugh. But I'm just trying to provide for it, trying to give you an instance where you may very well perceive a door, but it's open. And the important thing is that it's open, not that it's the door. I'm going to get myself in trouble here. Let's go on. Chapter 27. Subhuti, what do you think? Was it due to the possession of attributes that the Tathagata realized unexcelled perfect enlightenment? Subhuti, you should hold no such view. And why not, Subhuti? It could not have been due to the possession of attributes that the Tathagata realized unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Furthermore, Subhuti, someone may claim those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path announce the destruction or end of some dharma. Subhuti, you should hold no such view. And why not? Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path do not announce the destruction of the end of any dharma. Now, this is another way he's saying that, remember the nothing, the no thing that I was talking about? This is exactly what he's referring to. People will hear me, and I had somebody just recently tell me, well, you told me that our goal in our practice is to achieve nothing, nothingness, the word nothing. Well, again, the word goal gives it away, doesn't it? It's not that we're trying to get to nothing. It's that we're trying to get to no thing, no attachments. If you're not attached, it's no longer a thing. It's no longer a phenomenon. And where are you left when that happens? As human beings, that is exactly what is hidden from us. That is exactly what we have all these veils of misunderstanding about. If we can get through those attachments, we will be out of the cornfield. We will be breathing, floating, wonderful observers of the energy of life, the continuum of life. Remember, I've said before, birth and death are not opposites. Or life and death are not opposite. That's easier to understand. Birth and death are just a little experience within life, the energy of life. It's been explained as a coin. I don't know if that works for you. Birth and death, both sides of a coin. But I think that leaves out of the equation the whole of the energy of life. Birth is just a manifestation from karma. Death is the fading away of that manifestation back into life. From life comes birth for a brief period, and then death returns it to the fundamental Buddha, life force, life energy. Wish I had better light in here. All right. In the previous chapter, the Buddha told Subhuti that the Tathagata could not be seen by means of attributes that accompanied his realization of enlightenment. For no matter how perfect they might be, they are still only attributes, and their possession does not result in Buddhahood, but merely accompanies it. Throughout this sutra, the Buddha uses unexcelled perfect enlightenment as a synonym for his Dharma body, which is not subject to creation or destruction, but which is the only attribute a Buddha can be said to possess because it is no attribute. Attributes are something we're obsessed with as humans. You could read it as possessions, but blue eyes and long fingers are also possessions. That's what we mean by attributes. They're just another attachment. Come on, fingers. Furthermore, Subhuti, someone may claim those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path announce the destruction or the end of some dharma. Subhuti, you should hold no such view, and why not? Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path do not announce the destruction or the end of anything. In the creation of dharmas, even such dharmas as Buddha's perfect attributes is not related to enlightenment. What about their destruction? Do Bodhisattvas not bring about an end to suffering and destroy the basis of future rebirths through their countless acts of merit? What about such dharmas as these? Here too, the Buddha seeks to steer Subhuti away from any semblance of attachment. That's what we just talked about. Okay, chapter 28. What I'm doing here is I'm trying to help you study. You need to do this on your own and see your own things, but you may refer back to these videos once again. What was it Sylvain said about this? And you might argue with me, and I encourage you to send me an email or a comment on the video so that everyone can have an opportunity to see your challenge and see how I wriggle out of the problem. We're all practicing together. This is our sangha. So all we can do is improve ourselves, including me. I desperately need your commentary. Okay? And we may never agree. I hope that we do, because eventually not only will you learn something, but I also will learn something. And together we will get to more clarity. Okay? Chao Ming titles this, No Possession, No Attachment. Hui Ning said, he's a pretty simple speaker, straightforward. Hui Ning says, great minds achieve the acceptance of things because they are free of attachment. Their worldly merit is so great, why would they want to possess anything? Thus follows a chapter on no possession and no attachment. Furthermore, Subhuti, this is the actual sutra. If a noble son or daughter took as many worlds as there are grains of sand in the Ganges, oh, there's that old song, and covered them with the seven jewels and gave them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhans, the fully enlightened ones, and a bodhisattva gained an acceptance of the selfless, birthless nature of dharmas. In other words, they were never created. Not that they're negated, big difference. The body of merit produced as a result would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. And yet, Subhuti, this fearless bodhisattva, would not obtain a body of merit. There's those two languages mixing again. The body of merit is in the human condition. Okay? The body of merit produces a relevant scene. He's using body the same way. But he's trying to show that a bodhisattva who gets no birth, no being, no life, no soul, who gets that unattached place where not only those things, but everything related to those things stops controlling them, like the cigarettes, like the beer, like the whatever. Then his merit, which is spiritual, will be vast and immeasurable. Whereas if he doesn't let go of that attachment of self, body, being, life, soul, then all of the gifts he could give will render him no merit at all. It'll be illusional, or as is often said in this book, delusional. And maybe it needs to be stated that strongly. All right, in this sutra, the Buddha focuses on three of the six perfections. The first perfection of charity, the third perfection of acceptance or forbearance, and the sixth perception of wisdom. This is, after all, about the perfection of wisdom. Here, the Buddha merges all three. For when we give something, we must be able to bear its loss and accept its absence. Thus, charity and acceptance are two aspects of the same practice. It is the perfection of wisdom, however, that transforms this twofold practice. For it is by means of wisdom that we realize that the element of practice are empty, that there is no gift, no giver, no recipient, and thus no practice. Not only is there not now any practice, there has never been any practice, nor will there ever be any practice. And yet, instead of resulting in no merit, such realization results in obtaining a body of merit beyond the limits of conception. But a body of merit that is not obtained because such a body does not exist. For the hand cannot grasp itself. By realizing and accepting that all dharmas have no self, that they are not real, A bodhisattva gives up attachment to all created things. And only by giving up such pervasive, all-consuming attachment can a bodhisattva liberate all beings, beings who do not now exist, have ever existed, and never will exist. In later, more developed descriptions of a bodhisattva progress, such as that in the Dashabhumika Sutra, the term anupatika dharma kshanti, acceptance of birthlessness, is said to characterize the eighth of the 10 stages that culminate with Buddhahood, and which is the subject of the next chapter. How are we doing on time? Chifo says all dharmas must be selfless, but people are incapable of selflessness because they are incapable of acceptance. If they can't be accepting, how can they be selfless? But only through selflessness can they become accepting. All the other 5,000 worlds in this sutra, words in this sutra, sorry, merely explain these few which comprise the Buddha's essential teaching. The verb used here, parigraha, obtain, was traditionally used to describe a priest's receipt of a present from a king. But if the bodhisattva is a priest, who is the king? Who is it who presents the bodhisattva with this body, the perfection of wisdom, the mother of all sutras? Sing Chao says, hoping for a reward and focusing on oneself are what is meant by grasping. If no self or other remains, how can anything be attained? Once again, there's no goal here. There's no getting somewhere else. It's here already. We're all in the same energy. We just have put all these different colored glasses up on top of our vision, and we're not seeing through them. We need to remove veils, okay? Chapter 29, furthermore, Subhuti, if anyone should claim that the Tathagata goes or comes or stands or sits or lies on a bed, Subhuti, they do not understand the meaning of my words. And why not, Subhuti? Those who are called Tathagatas do not go anywhere, nor do they come from anywhere. Thus are they called Tathagatas, Arhats, fully enlightened ones. This is what we've been talking about. This is an extension of, if you're still attached to a self, a being, life, then that's the only way you can speak of the Tathagata going or coming, or sitting or lying down, or being anywhere or anything. That's illusory. That's samsara. From the very beginning of this sutra, the focus has been on the Buddha's body. And this sutra can be read as a meditation on the Buddha's body. But which body? It has sometimes seemed like the Buddha has been playing the old shell game with Subhuti. Now you see me, now you don't. Under which shell is the real Buddha? As early as chapter 5, the Buddha asked Subhuti if he could see his body. And with this koan, he began Subhuti's education in the perfection of wisdom. Obviously, the Buddha was not referring to his physical body, which Subhuti knew was empty of any self-nature and merely an apparition. But to which body was the Buddha referring, and why did he refer to bodies at all? Subhuti was known for his attachment to emptiness. Hence, the Buddha sought to lead him beyond emptiness by considering his reward body, which is a reflection of a Buddha's selflessness. The Buddha also urged Subhuti to cultivate his own reward body, which is called his body of merit, by resolving to liberate all beings without attachment to any being or to any self. However, while selflessness is the necessary cause of such bodies, selflessness itself turns out to be birthlessness. No self has never existed. Hence, one cannot transcend what one doesn't exist. Thus, the Buddha reward body and the Bodhisattva body of merit turn out to be no bodies, no bodies that arise from this teaching. If we wish to follow in the Buddha's footsteps, we need to find the Buddha's real body, his uncreated, indestructible body, his diamond body. In this chapter, the Buddha finally lifts the shell. Chao Ming titles this, The Utter Stillness of Perfect Deportment. Huineng says, Going and coming, sitting and lying down, all accord with reality. Thus follows a chapter on the utter stillness of a Buddha's perfect deportment. Tai Ching says, Though it has been said, and there is no self or recipient of merit, when the Tathagata appeared walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, was this not the Tathagata's self? This is because we view that his three bodies were both one and many, has not yet been eliminated, and because the undifferentiated nature of the Dharma body has not yet been understood. Furthermore, Subhuti, if anyone should claim that the Tathagata goes or comes or stands or sits or lies on a bed, Subhuti, they do not understand the meaning of my words. The Buddha uses two parsings of the word Tathagata here. Reading Tatha Agata, we have thus come, where thus refers to what Buddhists call suchness, and come refers to the Buddha's apparition body and his apparition appearance among mankind, in other words, in samsara. Since the Chinese prefer to emphasize the Buddha's compassion, they invariably translate Tathagata as Julai, thus come. Here, however, such a translation would be a mistake. The Buddha does not come. Reading Tathagata, the word also means thus go, and emphasizes the Buddha's transcendence of his physical body and full realization of his reward body, his enlightenment. But neither does the Buddha go, for if all dharmas are selfless and birthless, can anything be said to truly come or go? As the sutra nears the end, the Buddha finally tells Subhuti he was mistaken if he thought anything took place at all in the great city of Sarasthi or in Anathapindada garden, and he was also mistaken to think that he could follow the Buddha's footsteps when in fact there are no footsteps. In the Perfection of Wisdom, in 18,000 lines, Subhuti tells Shaka, the Tathagata cannot be known except through the fact that in his nature he has no fixed residence. He cannot be apprehended except through suchness, emulation. Without a fixed residence, chief of gods, all are all dharmas. Later in the same sutra, Subhuti also says, as the Tathagata's suchness neither comes nor goes, so also that of the Subhuti and the elder. For from the very beginning has Subhuti the elder come to be born after the image of the Tathagata. In the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, Dharmagata Bodhisattva says Tathagatas do not go anywhere, nor do they come from anywhere, because suchness does not move, and the Tathagatas are suchness. Those who grasp at a Tathagata through form or sound, or who think a Tathagata comes or goes, are fools. A Tathagata cannot be seen by means of its physical body. The Dharma is the body of a Tathagata, and the true nature of Dharmas does not come or go. The body of an elephant, a horse, a chariot, or a soldier conjured by a magician does not come or go. Likewise, Tathagatas do not come or go. The Buddha's body does not result from a single cause or condition. Wang Ji Hui says, a real Buddha has no appearance, thus he cannot be described as coming or going, sitting or lying down. If he could be described, he would have an appearance. Thus the Buddha says, such a view is at odds with his teaching. What the Buddha means by Tathagata is the real Buddha, and the real Buddha has no form, like the mind. Moreover, it fills the sky and the world, so how could it come or go? Tai Ching says, Subhuti still regards the one whose deportment is perfect, whether moving or still, as the Tathagata, but this is to hold the view of coming and going. How could the Tathagata come or go? At this point, Subhuti's attachments end, and his preferences are forgotten, and movement and stillness are no longer seen as different, but truly so, and in the realm of the real, which is the final mystery. However, his distinction of oneness and multiplicity has not been forgotten, and the meaning of one body with three forms has not yet been understood. Thus, in the next chapter, atoms and worlds are used to break through this. The Complete Enlightenment Sutra says, do clouds float by or does the moon move? Does a boat drift past or does the shore move? The moon doesn't move and the shore doesn't move. Likewise, the Tathagata's true body neither moves nor stays still. Its appearance and disappearance are visual errors. It's like the puzzle of does the chicken cross the road or does the road pass under the chicken? Dao Huan says, Chapter 29 explains the meaning at the beginning of the sutra where Subhuti asks the Buddha for instruction and can't keep from singing his praises. Chao Fo says, it was said that the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of attributes, and yet he does not lack attributes. Anyway, they're all basically saying the same thing. When we talked about the Lankavatara, the Avatasaka Sutra, you got a lot of reading to do, folks. But I don't want to be too redundant here because I think you get the gist of this. So I want to jump on to the next chapter. I'm already at 52 minutes, so I need to give you a break. I'm good. There's three last chapters, and that's where everything is condensed, so I'm going to read a lot, but because it's going to say things pretty obviously, that I don't think I need to translate for you, but I'm sure I'll interject something. So for now, the next video will be quite a bit shorter because it's not as much. I say that, but anyway, thank you. Thank you for listening and participating. Please make comments, ask questions. I love you for it. Okay? Let's realize Buddhahood together. Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. Bye for now.